Okay, we're happy to have Theo Johnson-Freud from Perimeter today, who will talk about a deformation invariant of 2D QFTs, proving that I can read the blackboard. I apologize that the announcement was sent around late. I forgot to send it earlier. But thank you for coming.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Is this a good size? Okay. So I'm going to tell you about 2D deformation invariant of SQFTs. And I was in the process of writing up the archive numbers. The most impressive feat of memorization that I've ever seen in a talk is people being able to recite these, and I cannot do that. So I did once give a talk where I managed to, and then I later wrote out the prime factorization of the monster. Nobody was impressed by that. That was something I had all seen before, but I can't do it right now. So I have three papers, actually. The main thing I want to tell you about is this most recent one from April. But it was a follow-up of a paper with Davide Gallotto. It was a follow-up of a paper from February with Edward Witten. And these, it's really a trilogy, but I'm not going to say anything that's really from the earliest paper. But if you really enjoy this, you can, I was proud of all three of papers, so. And they're all sort of contributing to the story that we're in the process of telling. So my goal will eventually for the talk be to explain what the title, as I say in the title, the deformation invariant to the super quantum field theories. And I'd like to warm up, I'll start by just setting some scene and sort of telling you the type of problem I'm thinking about. And I should also say, pretty much most of the talk is, although I'm a mathematician, most of the talk is going to be physics. And most of the physics is going to be what maybe even some HTH high energy physicists might think is conjecture and not physical theorem. So, grain of salt, and which means that I'm inviting all of you to help maybe fill in gaps, put it on more rigorous way. We have a picture of what's going on, but there's steps that need to be. So the general context of the question I want to ask. The general question I want to ask is of the following flavor. And you can ask various versions of this question. There's lots of versions that are interesting. The flavor of the question I want to ask is, what is the homotopy type? Or what can you say about the homotopy type? Can you calculate any homotopy groups, for example, of the space? And words like "the" you should find suspicious of your favorite type of quantum field theory. That's the general question. You could ask many variations of it just by deciding what type of quantum field theory you have. And I put "the" in quotes because even once you've decided what type of quantum field theory you like, actually topologizing that space is a subtle question. And I can give you examples where the same set of quantum field theories has various different natural topologies on it, and they change the homotopies. So it really is a meaningful question. And that's a big part of what I don't know how to do for what I'm telling. Well, the even more part that I don't know how to do is we don't really have a definition of quantum field theory, so I don't even know the set of points in this space. So for me, my favorite type of quantum field theory, is where I take two total dimensional, two space-time dimensional, minimally supersymmetric, this is also called, so 2D is also sometimes called 1 plus 1D, and it's also sometimes called 1D, and I apologize for that. Minimally supersymmetric, this is also called N equals 0, 1. And I'll try to say why it's called that in a moment. Let's always work with unitary theories. If you're a unitary theory, then you should be able to rotate, and so I don't have to care too much about whether I'm talking in Lorentzian or Euclidean signature. And then I'll come back to it, but I want compact quantum filters. So those are the theories I want. And I'll say a little bit about, okay, you all know what dimension is. I won't say anything about dimension. I'm not going to say anything about unitary. It's just a word that you should keep around all the time. Let me say briefly, roughly, what compactness means. I don't have a definition, even a physics definition, of what compactness means in 2D, let alone a mathematical definition of what a 2D quantum field theory is. We don't have that. But we also don't have a physics definition of compact 2D field theory. But the idea of compactness is that compactness, this should be some sort of spectral condition. Because the idea of compactness is that an example of some examples of compact theories, should be for instance, sigma models with compact target. If you don't know much quantum, I don't know most of you in the audience, and if some of you know some quantum field theory, I don't know for all of you. If you don't know what a quantum field theory is in general, you can be keeping in mind quantum mechanics. So quantum mechanics, all of these are sort of examples. So one-dimensional quantum field theory, that's the same as quantum mechanics, because the world line of the particle is the space-time, of the field theory. And a compact theory and a sigma model is just a particle moving in a space. So that's a quantum particle in a space on a manifold. So the Hilbert space for that is L2 functions on the manifold. And the Hamiltonian is just the Laplacian. And then you could ask, what characterizes compact versus non-compact manifolds? Well, you know that the difference between a compact manifold and a non-compact manifold is whether the Laplacian has discrete spectrum. So the compact corresponds to some discreteness of the spectrum. In fact, compactness is stronger than discrete spectrum. It also forbids spectrum from piling up too quickly at infinity. And another example of a compact theory is you might have a non-compact target. Non-compact target for a sigma model, but you might have a potential energy. Which sort of growing fast enough at infinity. Maybe. I think at least linearly is good enough. Fast enough. Not too slow. And the same remarks apply. So for instance, the harmonic oscillator. The harmonic oscillator is a particle moving on a line that's not compact. But the harmonic oscillator is compact. Is compact. Because the eigenvalues of the harmonic oscillator, again, even though the particle in the harmonic oscillator has infinite range of motion, the potential energy doesn't let the eigenvalues pile up. So this is the idea of what I have in mind of compact theory.
How about conformal field theory? Do you know what that means for conformal field theory? All the other words are rigorous.
So For example,
many
WZW models with compact group, I believe, are examples of compact filters.
But I'm just wondering, in general, you have a categorization. The WZW model fall into the first class.
Into what do you, in the sense of like the WZW model is built at starting as a sigma model with compact type.
That's that.
But you know that sigma model is typically not. Well, I'll say this all in a moment. But that sigma model is of course not typically conformal itself. And there's a subtle question that I don't know the answer to, which is whether theory is compactify or decompactify under a normalization group flow. But I do think an example of a compact quantum field theory are say rational CFTs. I think those are all examples of compactness. No, I got into a big argument with Zybrick about whether how good whether RG flowed down, whether the IR limits of compact theory stay compact. And at the end of the day, I decided he knows a lot more than I do about that question, and I should just listen.
Sorry, who was on which side?
I was, he says, mistakenly believing that the far IRs of compact theories are always compact, because that's true in the quantum mechanics case. But he was saying that, you know, so what can happen is that you can take a field theory. So what can happen is if you have some region of negative curvature, then that gets spread out. But if you have a closed manifold with some regions of negative curvature, I mean, maybe everything's negative, but then the whole thing might just spread out so much that nothing happens. Like, it might just evaporate. If you had a dumbbell, that region of negative curvature will spread out, but that's okay. It just bubbles off into two spheres. It's still compact. Since I don't have a definition, even a physics definition of compact, this is not a question we can, like, answer in a rigorous way. And somebody has to actually propose a definition. So let me just say in the quantum mechanics case what the definition is, so that you, or a good definition of in the quantum mechanics case. Since I have a little bit more time, I get to actually say this. So in the quantum mechanics case, compact quantum mechanics case is that the Wick rotated partition function converges. The x of minus tau h hat is trace class. For positive tau. There's a good definition of compactness that distinguishes the theories I want from the theories I don't want. And I would like compactness in general to be a similar condition that sort of some partition functions are sufficiently absolutely convergent. That's the idea of the definition. Okay. Only two boards. Okay. So I explain what compactness means. Let me say a little bit about what.
They're big boards.
Yeah, but
not that big. I've been known to store things on this little third board on the side.
Yeah. I don't think that.
So
I also promised to tell you what minimally supersymmetric means. So in 2D, I'll say it this way. So n equals 0, 1 means the following. So in 2D, two of the most important operators you might write down in a 2D quantum field theory, any 2D Q of T has two operators, as among its operators, it has a Hamiltonian, which generates flow in the time direction, and it has a momentum operator, which generates flow in the space direction. And there's two favorite operators, which if I'm in Lorentz signature, which I think I'm going to be right now, there's sort of the two light cone directions. I got this backwards. And so the two light cone directions are kind of the chiral and anti-chiral pieces. You might call this Z and this Z bar. And the generators of flow in those two directions are special. And the minimal supersymmetry means that you have an operator, an odd operator, you have a fermionic operator, bar, which is a square root of the flow in the forward direction, in the z bar direction. For some value of plus and minus that I'm not going to try to get right. So this is the generators of z by z bar. And that's the basic definition of supersymmetry. So to quickly explain what the space of field theories looks like, let me say a little bit more about, just to help you get some footing on the space of quantum field theories. This is not going to work.
I think we're in
418. 418, okay. Oh, that means your clock's wrong, too.
Yeah.
So, right, so what'll come back, what sort of a big part of the story is that for many purposes, there's a sense in which this fermionic operator, it's good to think of it as if it were the differential on something, even though it doesn't square to zero. And there's some conventions I'm leaving out. So of course, all operators should be self-adjoint. And when you really try to figure out what self-adjoint means in the fermionic case, there's a whole mess. And so there's some powers of I that I'm going to leave out. So some power. And I'm just going to actually, for this whole talk, assume that the square of minus one is good. This one will be right. I'm just going to leave out factors of minus one left. The square of minus one left in there. Yes, so, so what I was going to say is that, at least if you actually get this right, then this is, of course, the commutator of G-bar with itself. And so there's a sense in which if you think of G-bar as some sort of differential, then I'm telling you that that sort of translating in the Z-bar direction, the anti-holomorphic translation, is in some sense exact. And so the point of minimally supersymmetric theories is that they're very close to being purely chiral, pure, having only sort of the translation in the Z direction is interesting, but not in the Z bar direction. That's the general idea. So I'm going to write SQFT just for the space of these theories. And this is the space I want to understand. And I want to just mention a few more things about it to set the framework so that you have a good picture of it. So the first thing to mention about it is that even if you ignored the supersymmetry, if the way the physicists study these deformation problems, the way they ask are, can you rule out? I want to understand the homotopy theory of something. And the most basic question in homotopy theory is, can you decide whether two points are connected by a path? And a standard way that physicists protect points from being separated, from being, you know, points in you know, QFTs in it, from being in the same path component, so a standard way physicists use to tell apart the path components of a space is through anomalies. And in two dimensions, there's a very
very accessible anomaly. Even without the supersymmetry, there's a very accessible anomaly called which is called the gravitational anomaly. And I'll write it as C right minus C left. This is a formula that makes sense. Well, if you know the C theorem, this makes sense always. So this is a formula that certainly makes sense if you're a conformal field theory. And I want to flag that, what is the symbol? Some sort of flag symbol. I can't remember how Knuth draws it. So I want to flag something, which is that neither C right and C left, these can change under deformations. They're not deformation invariants. These are real numbers. They're positive real numbers. But they're not deformation invariants. But this difference, C right minus C left, is. Differences. And this difference has constrained values. So for bosonic theories, this difference is always an 8, it's always a multiple of 8. And for theories with fermions, like the supersymmetric theories I care about, this difference is always a multiple of a half. And so I might end up writing, I care about this case and I don't like that half, and I'll sometimes use the number n for twice the difference. Always going to be an integer. And what'll turn out is that this n will end up being, this will end up being a homotopical degree. This will be a homotopical degree. And so the first thing you see that the space of quantum field theories that I care about breaks into these z-many components. I'll just call the nth component sqftn. I'm going to skip some things, I want to give away a punchline before I even kind of continue on that I meant to give away at the very beginning. So, because you should never like make people wait for punchlines. The motivation for everything I'm doing, I meant to say this at the beginning. So I won't probably explain all the details, although you might be able to extract it from some other things I say, but this grading on SQFT there's natural ways to add and multiply quantum field theories together. And so it turns out that this is actually a Z-graded ring. You should think of this as a Z-graded ring, because you can add and multiply field theories. And the motivation for this talk is actually it's better than a ring. This SQFT is actually an infinity ring spectrum. Omega spectrum. And we think the motivating hypothesis is that it's the TMF spectrum. That's the motivation for all of what we're doing. And this hypothesis, this really leads to lots of physical of predictions. For instance, it led us to discover the invariant that I'm going to try to tell you about starting soon. The last thing I want to say, that's sort of general stuff, is that the space of quantum field theories has the spaces. Each component of this space has a flow on it. It's called renormalization group flow.
And that corresponds to basically just rescaling the metric on space-time. The downward limit is called the far IR, the far infrared, and the upward limit is the far ultraviolet of a theory. It's easy for a theory, this was what we were discussing before, it's easy to start at a compact theory and have it decompactify as you go to the far UV, and I don't know if it decompactifies in the far IR. And so you should imagine, in fact, the C theorem basically says that this is basically a Morse flow. Think of it as a Morse flow. It's not really Morse, it's really a Morse-bot flow. The critical loci, the fixed points of our normalization group flow, the critical points, these are the conformal field theories, or the superconformal field theories, rather. And this is expected to be, the critical points is probably a finite dimensional manifold. Whereas the whole space is some sort of infinite dimensional manifold. That's how you should think about this space. And I'll start telling stories where I'm kind of flowing up and down along the normalization curves. And this lets me really try to explain the topology I have in mind in this space.
Is there any limit on the value of n for a critical point? Could there be whole components that have no CFTs?
No, I can give you a CFT for any value
for
of
n.
Okay. Because I already told you n was constrained to be a half integer. And free fermion models already saturate all values. Yes, so I lied slightly. The grading on n isn't really 2z. Doesn't matter. The correct definition of SQFTn is a field theory whose gravitational anomaly is identified with the gravitational anomaly of n free fermions. And if there's, I can use right and left moving to get that number to come out right. But the space of free fermion models is not Z, but some spectrum with pi zero equals Z.
Okay.
And the grading should have been that spectrum.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I assume you don't know any compact conformal field which is not rational. So the only example you have is rational, is that true?
No. The U1 at any level is a perfectly good compact theory. Those don't have to be rational. Because, I mean, a circle with arbitrary radius is a perfectly good compact theory. Those are already conformal.
So they are compact in your sense?
They're compact in, well, I don't have a definition of compact. I want those to count as compact.
You want it to be compact.
I don't know a lot of quantum field theories one way or the other. So like my source of examples is mostly from our CFTs.
Well, the example I want to know is that if you have a rational conformal field with a C left, C right, or where the deformation invariant, because they are rational numbers.
Those are deformation invariant in the space of conformal field theories, but in the space of rational conformal field theories. Yeah, so the space of conformal field theories is probably finite dimensional manifold. And the space of rational conformal field theories is supposed to have the topology of Q inside of R.
Well, rational cannot be deformed just because the rational number, you know, the central charge of rational number cannot continuously
deform. I exactly agree with you. We're saying the same thing.
Yeah.
The space of rational conformal field theories is zero dimensional. It's completely disconnected.
Yeah.
It has the topology of Q. But I'm not thinking of the space of RCFTs. That space naturally fits inside of a larger space. Of all conformal field theories, which is finite dimensional manifolds, does have deformations.
Okay.
And that fits inside of this infinite dimensional space of all quantum field theories, not necessarily conformal. So that means that there's sort of, so now let me, great. So just to sort of finish the general warm-up is to say that this thinking about the Morse-bot thinking about the RG flow on this space is a more spot flow lets you really hope to understand the homotopy type of this space, and it lets you kind of give a working man's definition of the topology of this space. So the working man's definition, or the working mathematician's definition, and your working physicist's definition, even better. Physicist's definition of the topology on these spaces is that two SQFTs, are, let's say, deformation equivalent if they're related by various sort of moves. For instance, two theories of deformation equivalent if they're related, for example, by the usual deformations in Hepth, if related by, there's the sort of usual Hepth deformations. If you're really a mathematician, Hepth is high energy physics theory. The usual Hepth deformations, so like you deform one by a marginal irrelevant operator. I want theories, so that's standing at a point in the space, maybe a critical point, maybe not, I don't care, and moving, these are, or maybe even not marginal irrelevant. The marginal operators are the operators that are horizontal with respect to RG flow. Operator is just another word for tangent vector. But the operators give tangent vectors. So the marginal operators are the ones that go horizontally, the relevant operators are the ones that go down a little bit, and irrelevant means you go up a little bit. And, well, there's a deep question about whether some of these operators might take you out of the space of compact theory, so I only want to do deformations that are compact, that stay compact. But otherwise, I should be able to deform by an operator. That's a standard move in physics. You could change scale. That certainly should be a deformation invariant, or it should be sort of taking a theory to something related to it by an example of deformation. And then I'd like two theories if they flow to the same far IR, and if that IR is compact, then they should be. Then of course I should be able to flow all the way down and flow back up. So so two theories are going to be deformation invariant if they have the same, really, you know, if they're IR equivalent. And this is really a kind of condensed matter way of thinking about spaces of
quantum IR equivalent with the IR limit
with
being
compactness.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's all sort of how I want you to think about this space. And most of what I said is really independent of the problem I care about. Most of what I said is just about how to think about spaces and quantum field theories in general. And if you don't care about compactness, you could do the same analysis without demanding theories be compact. You might get a larger space, it might have a different homotopy. Let me start talking more about specific questions you can ask in the supersymmetric world. So in the presence of supersymmetry, there's some very special questions that you can start to ask. The physicists like to know the answer to. So there's sort of interesting questions. So for instance, if you have a theory, a quantum field theory, have some quantum field theory, a typical question you could ask is, does supersymmetry spontaneously break? This is a question about what the far infrared of the theory is. This is basically asking, is the far IR zero? The zero theory. The far IR concentrates you on the supersymmetric vacua, and I'm asking about whether there's any. Let me give examples of the three things I'm about to say. Well, I'll give examples all at the same time, actually, in a moment. So the three questions I could ask, another version of the question you could ask is, does F have a small all? So that's just, so the first one's just about renormalization group flow. You could ask, can you deform by an operator first and then do a renormalization group flow? Does F have a small deformation? Spontaneously breaks supersymmetry. And finally, the question I really care about, which is F deformation equivalent to? Is F homotopic to? To a theory with spontaneous supersymmetry breaking. And in case these are too abstract, or if you're not a kind of coming from physics, let me give some easy examples of this. So as an example, I'm going to write down a field theory for you, and you could take a theory with a, I can take a theory with a single non-compact boson, so R-valued non-compact boson. The standard name for a boson is phi. I need a supersymmetric theory, so I'll have a super partner. Psi bar. It's all the I'm in minimal supersymmetry, so I only have a right moving super partner. And I might also have a left-moving fermion. So this is what's called a scalar multiplet. And I might also have a left-moving fermion. I'll call it lambda. And when you have minimal supersymmetry, the superpartner of a left-moving fermion is a constant. It's auxiliary. So. Care about it. This is not a compact theory, but I can make it compact by turning on a superpotential. And the superpotential I want here is going to be, let's say, phi squared plus a constant. So just C. Now C is taken. What's a letter that's not? It's not already assigned.
A. Mu.
Mu. A. Mu is.
You don't like it.
Well, it's going to end up being a mass term. It's okay. Sure. Except I might get the sign wrong if I call it. I'm about to write down a mass term, so it's okay.
But you could call it M.
I could call it M. Let's call it M.
but then I think I should call in minus n. So this is just some words in physics. What ends up happening is that the Lagrangian for the theory, the superpotential means that the Lagrangian with the superpotential is whatever the Lagrangian for the normal stuff, so that's like, I don't know, phi d phi plus psi bar d psi bar lambda d lambda plus whatever. I don't know. And then the interesting parts are, and I forgot which one's a bar and which one's not. I think the bar goes there. And then the superpotential turns on a potential energy. There's a bosonic part of the potential energy, which is basically the square of this. And then there's a fermionic part that's just Yukawa coupling. Something like lambda phi psi. Something like that. So the interesting thing is this potential. And what you discover is you discover that when m is negative, this theory already has spontaneous supersymmetry breaking. Because this potential energy, when m is negative, this potential energy is always above zero, so there's no supersymmetric constant. And this enjoys situation one. When m is positive, this is a family of theories, just parameterized by m. When m is positive, this theory has two ground states. So this is a standard Mexican hat potential when m is positive. So when m is positive, there's two ground states. And you can work it out. This ends up being, this theory ends up being in the far IR, it has two massive vacua, and they have different signs. So in the far IR, it flows to just the trivial theory, so the theory one plus kind of the ARF theory. And, but because this is a family, so this is not the zero theory, supersymmetry is not spontaneously broken, but it's deformation equivalent to one, spontaneous supersymmetry breaking. So what I'm telling you is that this theory, this TFT, this is just a topological field theory. This topological field theory trivial plus ARF is, it's a topological field theory. It doesn't have any deformations at all. So it no to one, no to two, but yes to three. And then when m is exactly zero, this flows to some conformal field theory that I haven't actually worked out, but it shouldn't be too hard, and that enjoys number two. So there's an example of all three. A more sophisticated example that we worked out in the paper with Edward, which really was what sort of starts the main new work. This is stuff that's sort of textbook, basically. A more sophisticated example is that you could take the S3 sigma model. So the sigma model, will target the round S3. The sigma model so remember that I have minimal supersymmetry. And that means that in a sigma model, this means that at least in the ultraviolet, my fields, I have a boson valued in S3, a scalar boson valued in S3, and I have its right-moving superpartner.
And there's an anomaly from that fact that I've unmatched fermions. Unmatched fermions lead to a potential anomaly. And so you need to choose some anomaly trivialization data. So I need to define the signal model. So what I'm telling you is that the signal model is not well defined, as I've said it. Not yet a valid thing. To define the signal model, I have to tell you, I have to give anomaly cancellation data. The anomaly cancellation data that I need in the mathematics literature goes under the name of a string structure. And in the physics name, it goes under the name, in physics, it's called a quantum B field. Typically, this cancellation data, if it exists, it might have an obstruction. If it exists, then it exists in a coarser form, H3 of whatever your target manifold is. And in the case of, in the S3 case, this torsor is trivializable. This torsor is canonically trivialized. And so I can start referring to numbers. So I'll write S3k for the signal model. Yes, there's signal model with string structure. That's the example I really care about. And I can tell you what we think the far IR is. So I can answer, for instance, this sort of question. Well, I erased them already. These questions. So we're pretty sure that we know what the far IR of this sigma model is. So we're pretty sure that the far IR flows to the following. Oh, I should say, how do you do this type of problem at all? Before I tell you the answer, let me tell you how one even solves the question of what is the far IR. The standard methods. It's a really sort of terrible situation. Physicists don't have really good tools for answering this problem. It's a really hard non-perturbative problem. And the only methods that physicists have are you write down every symmetry you can think of. RG flow preserves symmetries. There might be more symmetries in the IR than there were in the original theory, but it certainly doesn't destroy any. So now and the far IR is always going to be conformal. So now you write down every CFT you can think of with those symmetries. And you know, this is a real problem of like maybe you just don't know very many CFTs, and then you might miss something here, and then you anomaly match. And that's really the only method. That's how all problems of kind of
so this this sequence example, that this is not the same as you take SU2 level 4k plus 2.
Well, we're about to give the answer.
Okay.
So when you do this algorithm, you get what is quite clearly the correct answer for this problem, which is that in the far IR for this problem, you get a 0-1 WZW model for SU2. In the 0-1 WZW model, there's
the left moving field, there's sort of a list of the sort of basic data in the WZW model. There's some this has kind of chiral currents, left moving currents, J123. Right currents, J bar, and fermions, psi bar. And the left currents have bosonic WZW mid level, K minus 1. In this case, when you calculate the correct anomalies for this theory. And it's sort of well known that these guys are also K minus 1 as their own. Like, they generate a WZW algebra with just level K minus 1, but you can combine them with the fermions and get another WZW model with level K plus 1. So the fermions add 2 to the level of the WZW algebra. Well, this can't be true, because the level's always positive. So this is if K is at least 1. If K is at least minus 1, is negative, if K is at most minus 1, then the correct answer was to get this. I should have put an absolute value around K. And I think the supersymmetry is spontaneously broken. So that was situation 1, if K is equal to 0. But it might have been situation 2, and we just might not have seen a theory. But by we, I mean Edward Witten, could not come up with any possible theory, and so he's pretty confident that this is right. So that's a situation 1. And I want to give another example of case 3. Which is the following. I could take a K3 surface, and I can try to write down a sigma model. Well, the K3 surface sigma model doesn't work, because this has an obstruction, an anomaly. I mean, it has an obstruction. Except, I mean, there's no string structures. It's sort of unstringable. A string structure is like a spin structure. It's a trivialization of something, just like a spin structure is a trivialization of a characteristic class. But I could take the K3 surface and I could subtract a point. And I think all spaces minus a point, all spaces look like tori, and all spaces minus a point look like tori with a neck. So here's going to be my picture of K3 minus a point. And this is not a compact theory, but it's still a valid target, but it is a valid SQFT, which is it's not a point in my moduli space, but it's a perfectly good theory for you to consider. And it has a function on it, just the projection down to the real numbers, which becomes an operator in the theory. So there's some operator in this sigma model. Let's call this, I don't know, let's call the whole theory name. And this is not a compact theory, but something I can do is I can try to force this operator to take a specific value. I can try to look at slices of this operator. And there's a way to do that, but never, like, I'm going to draw it in the case of a sigma model, but it works in any quantum theory. You can take slices of an operator by turning on a Lagrange multiplier. So I want to consider the fibers of this operator phi, And I do that by using, I do that with Lagrange multipliers. Specifically, I consider the theory X. I add a fermion, right-moving fermion. No, left-moving fermion. Fermi multiply. And I'll call it lambda for Lagrange multiplier. And then I change the superpotential. Will be lambda times phi minus m. And now you see the same situation that we were in before with the free boson. So the free boson case was just when I had this situation. And then I get the factors. People are evaporating.
Nothing personal.
So what you find out when you do this is you find out that you get the fibers of the map. And what you find out is that when m is very positive, when m is positive infinity, then the fiber of this map is an S3 sigma model. And then this is, get an S3 sigma model. And it's a topology calculation to work out what the string structure is. And it's actually S3 with string structure 24. And when m is very negative, you get nothing at all. And you get zero. And so that means that S3 with 24 strength of sigma model, this has property 3. It can be deformed to one that's something in the super structure. Okay. That was all. So it's a little before 5, so I still have some time. So that was the sort of the background, and then the point, what our goal was to show that this 24 was force. So the next thing you could ask is how to protect a theory. I give you some theory. I give you S3 with level 1. How could you maybe show that it's not deformation equivalent to one spontaneous supersymmetry, right? That it's not null homotopic? From this sort of being null homotopic. Well, of course, there's an easy answer to that. What you need is an invariant, a deformation invariant, quantum field theories, which is computable. Say additive, vanishes on the theory with on if supersymmetry is spontaneously broken. And of course not zero for your theory. That would be good enough. And that's the thing I was advertising in my title, was an example of one of those. Rapidly running out of good chalk. So there's a famous example of an invariant like this. Such an invariant
which is variously called the elliptic or Witten genus. And its definition is that it's just the partition function. I write it as ZRR of F. So this is the partition function of F on flat torite. And the RR means non-bounding spin structure. This is a very standard construction. I'm going to review some facts about it just in case you haven't seen it or in case you need a refresher, but I'm hoping that they're good facts you've seen. So first fact that I want to mention is that the space of flat tori with non-bending spin structure, this space is a three-real dimensional space. So this space is three-real dimensional. And it's three-real dimensional, and it, at least if I complexify the functions, there's the natural coordinates on it are, the natural coordinates are sort of the standard tau and tau bar to tell you the conformal structure of the torus, and also the volume. So a priori, this is a function of three variables. But maybe the very first facts that you prove. Oh, and then, you know, I didn't give you a definition of quantum field theory. So compactness implies that this partition function even converges at all. I mean, you don't need that much. You don't need all of compactness to do that, but compactness is certainly strong enough to do that. And whatever a quantum field theory is, I'm going to assume that there's some sort of, I'm going to assume some real analyticity. I build that in somewhere into my definition of compact or my definition of unitary or something like that. So there's two standard facts. The very first standard fact that you might prove about this partition function is that although a priori it's a function of three variables, in fact it's only a function of one variable. And then, well, because I defined it on flat tori, that means that I have a holomorphic function of the moduli space of tori. So I get a modular form. It's called a weakly holomorphic modular form. Weakly just means a pole at the cusp. A weakly holomorphic modular form. And up to some powers of zeta kind's eta function. There's some normalization. Factors of zeta kind's eta function. So some power. And also, of course, I'm still in the convention work. I'm not going to care about factors of I. It's a weakly holomorphic modular form. And after you correct something that it's a weakly holomorphic modular form, of weight, this gravitational anomaly. And the second fact is that the Q expansion of this modular form is actually integral. These are standard facts.
standard facts. I'll remind quickly the proofs because I'm going to use them in a moment. The proof goes as follows. So it's a general fact that if you differentiate, say, in the tau bar direction on any quantum field theory, that's always the same. Well, it's always proportional to, there's some constant of proportionality that I'm leaving out. That's always proportional to the one-point function of the stress energy tensor in the z bar component of the stress energy tensor. Brackets mean one-point function. This is always on non-bounding tori, and this is the stress energy tensor. And then the stress energy tensor in the z bar component is actually, in the case of a supersymmetry, the stress energy tensor in the z bar component is sort of super exact. I told you at the beginning, you should think of the supersymmetry as being a differential on some complex. And so this is actually super exact. So this is G bar acting on its own Z bar component. And then in the Ramone-Ramone, in the odd spin structure and not in the even spin structure, in the odd spin structure, the one-point functions of super exact objects always vanish. So that you should think of this as being, basically, if you take any operator, the supersymmetry is acting like a differential. And what I'm telling you is essentially that the derivative, that the integral of a total derivative, and if I cared about the volume one, then I would have used the Tz bar z component, the diagonal component of the stress energy tensor, and I would have used the diagonal component of the supersymmetry. And the second standard fact, the proof of the second standard fact, is that this partition function, I defined it by saying I want the partition function on its two torus, but I can compute this partition function kind of on a two torus by first compactifying on an S1 with non-bounding spin structure. Say on an A cycle S1. Now, when you compactify on an A cycle, now you have this produces an S1 equivariant supersymmetric quantum mechanics model. And this elliptic genus is just the equivariant index of this quantum mechanics model. So the S1 equivariance ends up being the parameter Q in the Q expansion. And the elliptic genus is the index. And everybody knows that indexes of supersymmetric quantum mechanics models are. There's Y. So this was all well and good. So this tells you, for instance, that as soon as you have a quantum field theory, with non-trivial, and these two properties together imply that it's a deformation invariant. So this is all well and good if your elliptic genus is not zero. But what about if your elliptic genus is zero? Oh, shoot. So I'm really running out of space. So what about if your elliptic genus is zero? So the problem is that I have a modular form, a holomorphic, a weakly holomorphic modular form. And there aren't very many weakly holomorphic modular forms. The problem is, for instance, there are no weakly holomorphic modular forms, for instance, of weight 3/2. That would be nonsense. But, for instance, this S3K theory that I cared about has C right minus C left equals to 3/2. So its elliptic genus is just going to vanish identically. Doesn't help. Well, the elliptic genus itself doesn't help decide if, say, S3 with level 1 is null homotopic. Doesn't help at all. It's just zero for, you know, you don't have to do any computation. It's just zero.
Was there a K in that formula for the index?
No. This is always, if you had an M manifold.
I only ask because you drew a conclusion for S3-1, not S3-K.
What's the general formula you started saying?
If you have a manifold, a d-dimensional manifold for a sigma model, then the manifold C right minus C left is always D on 2. I told you that this number, or they should have called it an N manifold, because this was going to be N on 2. And I told you that N was going to play the role of a homotopical degree. And, well, I erased it already, but the argument I gave you, as an aside, the argument I told you about the K3 model actually tells you that the map that assigns the sigma model to a manifold is actually a map from string cobordism to the space of quantum field theories. And then this dimension is just the homotopical degree in string cobordism. That was what's going on in the back.
But the reason I was puzzled by your formula is that you said S3K flows to SU2 level K or something.
Yeah, I did.
But that's the upper limit is 3, right? But I thought the flow always go downwards.
It does always go down. The C right for, I told you that S3K, this difference is always 3/2. But, like, this is going to flow to a WZW, and C right is going to be something, and C left is going to be that. Well, remember, the right moving part is just about, sorry, the left moving part, what am I trying to say? The left movers are purely bosonic. So that'll be something like 3K over K plus 1, 2. And the right movers are the bosonic thing plus 3 free fermions, the superpartners of the bosons.
Okay, that's smaller.
But as you see, like it started out, C right and C left in the far UV are each, like, in the far UV, this is actually just saturated with 3/2, and it's like 3/2 and 6/2, or whatever it is.
Read it.
Three. Maybe it's just 3.
6/2 is 3.
Yeah. Well, that's the
no, it's like 3 and 3 plus 3/2.
Yeah, 3 and 3 plus 3/2.
Sorry, right, because when k is very large, this is 3.
Yeah.
And that makes sense in the far UV. What you see is something that, like in the far UV, the fact that it was a globally curved manifold is sort of, it's a really big manifold. And so you see a free boson. Three free bosons on the left, and you see three free bosons and their superpartners on the right. Anyway, the elliptic genus doesn't help. So now I want to do a thought experiment. Let's suppose that I have some, I'll draw the same picture I drew before, but now I don't want you to think that it's necessarily a sigma model. Suppose you have some theory Y, and let's suppose that its elliptic genus vanishes. In fact, let's suppose that it is null homotopic. Let's suppose that I'll call this the plus infinity value of a family, and I'll have some family of theories where out here at minus infinity I just get spontaneous supersymmetry break. Suppose I have a family like this. Then I'll undo the thing I did before with Lagrange multipliers. What I can do is I can take this parameter m and I can dynamicalize the parameter. When you dynamicalize M, you turn it into a boson itself. It picks up its own superpartner. So this becomes a boson. You get, maybe I'll call it phi. You get the superpartner psi. And you can go the other way. So dynamicalizing takes you to some new theory. You could have gone the other way by, I'll call the new theory X. You could have gone the other way with the Lagrange multipliers that I explained before. This is part of the spectrum, the omega spectrum structure. So I get a new theory X, and it's not compact. The theory just looks like the picture I drew before. It looks like it has an end that whose fibers look like Y, and then it just sort of has some stuff. And here's what X looks like. Anyway, perfectly good quantum theory, not compact, but we can still try to evaluate our favorite invariant on it. It might not be an invariant, it might not have all the nice properties that the invariant would have had, but we can try. So we can try to evaluate the partition function on this non-compact theory. You might worry it doesn't converge because it's not compact, but it's okay. This end is, like, the fibers have zero partition function. And so the contribution from the end is zero times infinity, which is actually more zero than it is infinity. At least in quantum mechanics, it would be zero. So let's hope that this converges. As I said, this was all conjecture. So this probably converges. Probably makes sense because the contribution from the end is zero times infinity. As I said, the zero sort of is stronger than the fact that it's infinite. But we can ask those two questions. I erased them because I. But we can ask, like, what is it? You know, but what is it? So if we can ask, you know, is it holomorphic? Again, a priori, this depends on three parameters. Does it really only depend on tau bar? And we can also ask about integrality. I mean, the holomorphic part's the more interesting part. So I told you before, the same thing goes through. I could say you look at the partition, the derivative in the tau bar direction, for instance. And, well, that's all still doesn't matter. It's still the one-point function of some component of the stress-energy tensor, still proportional to it, which is still a supersymmetry, a superdescendant. But because we're not compact, remember, I told you that the super, that the, if you, I told you, you know, this was supposed to be kind of the integral of a total derivative. And if you have a boundary, if you have a non-compact object, then the integral of a total derivative does not vanish, but rather has a boundary term. And so it's reasonable to think that the integral of a total derivative in a non-compact theory looks like the, well, or at least is proportional to the partition, the one-point function of that operator in the boundary theory. And, well, we did a whole lot of examples to set the proportionality constant because we, I don't know, path integral arguments aren't very, even physicists don't trust path integral arguments. So instead, we did a whole bunch of examples to set the proportionality constant, and what we find is we find that this is actually, what we found was, we're pretty sure that minus a tau 2 is the imaginary part of tau, square root of minus 8 tau 2 is some factors of I square root of minus 1 and Dedekind's eta function, neither of which matter. You can just set them like those don't matter, times the one-point function of the supersymmetry operator in theory 1. And similarly, you'll have a formula for the derivative in the volume direction, which will be proportional to the one-point function of the other components of the supersymmetry operator, the z component, the sort of diagonal, the mixed component of the supersymmetry operator. This is zero if y is confirmed. Sorry, I won't worry about it. You can also ask about the integrality, and I won't say much. But so what do we have? We have some function. Let's say y is there's no volume dependence. Let's say y is conformal. Then I have a real analytic modular form. And you can still ask about the integrality of the real analytic modular form. So let's set, I'll write f hat, so it's tau bar, so it'd be this partition function of the bulk. I can ask, what's its Q expansion? Well, to take the Q expansion, I need to just take the tau part of it. So I can define f of tau to be just the tau part, the limit as tau bar goes to minus I infinity of f hat. And this is something I can Q expand. And the Q expansion, this breaks manifest modularity, by the way. When you run the Q expansion argument I gave you before, you're secretly taking this limit when you did that compactification process. So this happened when you compactified on S1. And the Q expansion of F is going to end up being integral. Well, it's not quite integral. It's integral plus some explicit correction, which is related to the Atiyah Podoti Singer eta invariant, and usually zero. But it's something explicit, something I can just break down. It's zero in most examples. I can give an example of itself. So let me summarize, because I'm basically at the end of the talk, and I'm basically at my punchline. So what I told you is the following. I told you that take an SQFT with vanishing elliptic genus, and do the following. First, solve this holomorphic anomaly equation. Given theory Y, you solve this holomorphic anomaly equation, That's not canonical. Let's say that Y is an SCFT. Solve the holomorphic anomaly equation. Well, this wasn't fully determined, but so f hat's not determined by the theory Y, but the class of f hat in real analytic modular forms modulo holomorphic modular forms is determined by Y, because the ambiguity in solving this was the holomorphic modular forms, the weakly holomorphic modular forms. Then, that was the first step. And the second step is Q expand. So look at the expand, Q expand. So look at the class of the so in the language of Mach modularity, which is what I'm secretly doing, this is like a harmonic Mach form, and this is the corresponding Mach modular form. So you Q expand, and you look at the class of F in Q expansions, modulo modular forms. And what we find out is that if Y is null homotopic, then, well, then this class is not zero, but it is integral. Which is to say that this class, if I quotient it further by integral Q expansions, then this is it. This vanishes. So theory Y determined this class, and I'm saying it's zero in this further quotient. And this is our invariant. And then just to finish, we could work and dig into the Mach modularity literature, and where people had already really studied these exact problems. And what we found was that for this WZW model with levels kind of k minus 1 and k plus 1, so this is what we thought, remember, was the 3k sigma model. What we find is that this class is, well, you can do it explicitly. So the Mach modularity literature provides an explicit solution. This ends up being a problem of finding a Mach modular form with an explicit, with a some specific vector. So like, it's a problem of like finding some vector value Mach modular form with some specific shadow. And so then we can just like look it up and then work a while to Q expand. And what you find is that this Q expansion ends up being the explicit function f that you can write down ends up being like kg2 minus kg2 plus something, plus integral. So g2 is the weight to Eisenstein series. And of course it starts off like 1 and 24. Plus integral. And so what we find that S3K is null homotopic if and only if. So the if direction I already explained, and the only if is from here. K is only 24. I'll finish. Thank you.
Any questions?
So I guess nobody speculated if you drop super unit, what's the top, what's the space looks like?
Oh, no, there's lots of speculation.
Really?
Yeah, it's contractible.
It's contractible. Okay.
I mean that's a speculation. Okay. In the quantum mechanics case, you can prove it's contractible. Okay. The appropriate topology in the quantum mechanics case. So I told you this motivating hypothesis about topological modular forms. In the quantum mechanics case, if you take any the minimally supersymmetric quantum mechanics, then you get K theory. I guess you get KU if there's no time reversal, and KL if there's 2 squared equals to plus 1, and you get some interesting space that nobody's studied, which is not a spectrum, a space but not a spectrum. Is minus 1 over F. I don't know what it is. It's like something. It would be good to do. And this is if you use the strong convergence of the result. Some specific topology. I mean, I can tell you. You use the strong operator topology in the space of Hilbert spaces, and you use the strong convergence of the resolvent on the space of Hamiltonians. In that topology, if you just took the space of bosonic quantum mechanics or fermionic quantum mechanics without a supersymmetric spectrum and you get zero in this, then you would get the trap.
Well, you get the gravitational anomaly. So you get contractibility of every component, but the gravitational anomaly is something easy. It's...
If that's the case, then this whole story is the same as condensed matter, which is the space of a quantum filter is contractible, and then all you capture is the symmetry. So this is just an SPT in the...
Right, that's exactly right. So this is...
just a supersymmetry protected.
That's right. No, I mean, I think that's the picture that we have in mind, is that when there's no supersymmetry, the only invariant, the only deformation invariant is the anomaly. And so then exactly, like, you might have a group, you might be like theories with a fixed group, and then the anomaly includes SPTs for that group. And as you said, in the presence of supersymmetry, it's somehow really different. Also, if I dropped compactness altogether, if you work with really non-compact objects, it's really easy to deform from something to something else because you have too much room. And so Zyberg, for instance, is willing to conjecture that there's a contractibility of supersymmetric theories if he takes all of them.
Okay, so the departure comes from this is a subspace of that contractible space.
Yeah. Now, if you take all of them, then the Witten genus doesn't converge, so that's consistent. I mean, you can just move through places where it doesn't converge, and then it's allowed to jump.
Okay, that's very interesting, actually. Because we do some kind of related symmetry protective, but we cannot do continuous symmetry. This is a continuous symmetry, the supersymmetry. Yes.
Well, and it's more than that, because I think even if I had a bosonic continuous symmetry.
Well, we don't know how to do that.
Well, I would guess that at least in the topologies I have in mind, the only invariant is the anomaly.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. In kind of matter, also people don't know the topology either. So.
Right. So. Well, again, I mean, the only one I can do mathematically is because of quantum mechanics. And in that case, it's still true. If I could take the space of quantum mechanics models with G symmetry and for GLE group. And if I don't have any supersymmetry, that's still contractible up to the anomaly. And in the K-theory case, it's the K-theory of the group. But no, there's something really different about supersymmetry. I don't know. I have this sort of hope that any time that the condensed matter theorists like to use K-theory for calculating things, we'll be able to do an enhanced version using this sort of, like, for instance, imagine sort of doing band structure. The most sophisticated band structure stuff is where you kind of write down K-theory classes and let them move around. And I kind of have this hope that we could do these TMF classes instead.
More questions? Thanks again.
I'm going to talk this long another thing.